Hello and welcome to How to Save the World with me, Tim Batt.
And me, Waveney Waugh.
This is a sustainability podcast for people who want to get into sustainability, or maybe you're already in that space and you just want to figure some stuff out and do better and learn. Right?
Yeah.
That's what we're here to do.
That's right.
And inspire, hopefully. And we talk about a little different topic each time, or sometimes a guest. No guest this time.
We're doing just me and you.
We're doing a deep dive. And we're talking about coffee.
Actually, I have to be honest, Tim, when you first suggested it, I thought you meant you wanted to take me for a coffee. And then I realised
we can totally do that as well.
Just do coffee in the episode.
I don't think that me taking you for a coffee is going to be the most dynamic podcast episode. But we can just do that off the mic anyway. That'll be fine.
Okay.
For right
coffee,
now, though.
Coffee.
One of life's great joys. I love coffee. You love coffee.
I do love coffee.
The world loves coffee. Coffee's been around since the 13th century. Do you know that? Like, as in the form that we have it now. It's even older. They used to wrap it in animal fats, I think, in Africa, and eat it as a food as far back as 1,000 years ago.
That is interesting because, by contrast, we've got this tree called a medlar, which is a fruit tree, and it's from that around about that same time. It's a middle-aged fruit, as in from the Middle Ages fruit tree. And it's a shocker. It's just the most awful thing to eat. And amazingly, it sort of predated our modern use of pears and apples and things, I think, because it was common back then. I was like, geez, this is as good as it got back then.
Well, that's the thing.
And at that same time, we had coffee.
All the fruits and veggies that we've got now are like hugely different to how they used to be because of selective breeding.
We didn't all Bananas have coffee though, did we? I don't think they were sipping on in England.
Well, it only grows in certain places in the world. This is the thing. So it requires pretty specific climates, which we will get into in just a moment. Before we do though, did you know that we drink, as a planet, humans, 2.25 billion cups of coffee per day?
Okay. So that's less than one each.
Yeah.
But that's
how many of us are there now? Eight billion?
Seven, isn't it? Or is it
seven?
No.
Seven or eight, somewhere in there. 7 or 8 billion people.
So that's across all cultures. So you can knock out China because they're not really drinking
the entire
coffee, are they?
Planet is
Somebody's drinking a lot of coffee.
2.25 billion. Well, the biggest country in the world per capita for coffee drinking is Finland. And those first slots are occupied almost solely by Scandinavian countries.
What? I would not have guessed that.
New York City is one of the biggest as a city.
I love it.
So where does coffee come from, Wave? We know we love it. We know we drink it. Do you want to hazard a guess? What's the top coffee country in the world?
Where did it originally come from?
Where do we get the beans?
South America.
True. What country is the biggest exporter of coffee, do you think?
Brazil.
You got it.
Is it?
It absolutely
real?
Is.
I was just
yes.
guessing.
You nailed it.
I didn't even know the continent to start with. That's amazing.
They supply over a third of the world's coffee beans. The other countries that are the big exporters, number two is Vietnam, and then it's Colombia, Indonesia, Ethiopia, and Honduras.
Okay. All the tropics.
Yes. Just so you know as well, so what I'm going to cover off, I should have said this right at the start, but what I'm going to cover off is a bit about, like, we'll get a bit of a picture of we all know what's so great about coffee, I hope you have been introduced to the wonders, the joys of coffee in your life. And I want to talk a bit about where it comes from, what changed in the 70s. There was a big change which created quite a lot of problems and some solutions as to how we can fix those things now.
Okay. Sounds good.
So, there's two main varieties of the coffee plant that we use to drink. There is Arabica and Robusta. Have you worked in a cafe before?
No.
Okay. Baristas will know this. And coffee connoisseurs will know this. Yeah. So Robusta is what's usually used for instant coffee. Not solely, but it's used in espresso as well, but it's generally rated as like a lower quality coffee. It makes up about 30% of the world's coffee supply is Robusta, and it's called Robusta, I think, because it's a more robust growing plant. Arabica, which is the one that's predominantly used, it has a better flavor profile. It's a lot harder to grow. You've got to be at quite a high altitude to grow Arabica. It only grows between 600 and 2,000 meters above sea level, and you need a cool subtropical climate and a lot of moisture, rich soil, and generally speaking, sun and shade.
Wow, it's very interesting.
Coffee plants.
Doesn't sound easy to grow.
No, it traditionally grows under canopies, so under the shade of trees, and it needs sunlight, but it actually doesn't like a ton of direct sunlight. So it's quite specific about where coffee can grow. So with those countries that I mentioned, Brazil being number one, Vietnam, Colombia, Indonesia, Ethiopia, Honduras, and so the list goes on, they've got a few things in common. One is that, generally speaking, their economies are a bit delicate, and so are their ecosystems. So there's a lot of damage that has been done and potential damage that gets done to both the environment and to sort of the people chain that's involved with cultivating coffee and exporting it as a product. And I mean, if you think of places like Brazil and Honduras, these are incredibly rich forests, rainforests with really diverse ecosystems, and they're really biodiverse. A thing happened in the 70s though that changed the way we make coffee. And it was very bad. It's very detrimental for the environment.
I am intrigued. What was it?
So in the 70s.
Is it something that our listeners would know? Go, oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't think. Okay. So, well, I was very surprised. But I don't know. I can't speak for everyone.
Yep.
So this is something that I just, you know, stumbled upon in researching this episode. So the traditional cultivation of coffee plants requires a really biodiverse environment. You basically need a big forest. You need bird life to keep on top of the pests, like insects and stuff, to stop it from growing and things that eat the fruits too early. So you need a lot of different things living together, typically, to create it. Then in the 70s, and I'd ran out of time, unfortunately, to get to the bottom of this, but I think they might have had a slightly different strain, which they either like GM'd or selectively bred of a slightly new kind of coffee plant. And they started sun cultivation, or what's called full sun farming of coffee
words,
plants.
Industrial agriculture. Yes, took correct. It out of the forest. And
it's a combination of two things. Three things really. One, monoculture. So it's just coffee plants being grown en masse without anything else in the area. Two, direct sunlight. They've figured out a way that you can actually do it so that these plants are just getting hit with sunlight all the time, which makes them fruit more, so that you've got more beans that are being produced per, you know, hectare. And the third component, which is absolutely necessary to this and why this happened in the 70s, is you need fertilizers to make this happen. So you actually need a ton of fertilizer, and these are nitrogen fertilizers, which you know quite a lot about.
Yeah, we've done this in other episodes, haven't we?
We have indeed, yeah. So what this resulted in is a huge amount of deforestation, particularly in Central America. Obviously, if you're trying to get the most bang for your buck and you're a coffee farmer and you found a way to just grow nothing but coffee, whereas instead you used to have a big forest just
such
to get the coffee
shame,
beans.
That's a shame, isn't it? There's this sentimentality of imagining of how beautiful that way of farming was.
Yeah, and it's not like it's gone, you know, completely from planet Earth, but this certainly was a really bad thing that swept you know, the globe. The other thing to remember with coffee is, like, coffee is so hugely popular everywhere in the world. There's a stat that gets bandied out, and it's not exactly true, but it's very close to true, which is that coffee is the second most traded commodity in the world after oil.
I bandy that.
Yeah, it's almost true, but it's not quite true. It was actually a misquote from some, I think, a UN book of statistics from quite a few years ago.
It does seem amazing. Yeah.
It's very close to true. Yeah. But it's coffee. Like, this isn't something necessary for life. It's not something necessary for industry.
Yeah.
Except
you would think it would be, I don't know, flour or, I don't know, something that you really needed.
Considering the first one's oil, you'd think number two would be like water or something, right? But it might be in the future. Grim. Anyway, we're talking about coffee.
Anyway, yeah.
So, so there was this whole revolution in the 70s. And this kind of put me on a bit, there were two little side stories here that I kind of got driven into when I started reading about this revolution that happened in the 70s of this different way to grow beans using fertilizer and direct sunlight. The first was the Green Revolution, which was in the 1910s, where this was the dawn of the scientific community inventing a method to create nitrogen in a lab.
Oh.
Something called the Haber-Bosch process. So these chemists cracked a way to be able to, I guess, extract and harness and collect and store nitrogen. And that fed into the ability to produce ammonia, which gave us all of these plant fertilizers. And off the back of that, so this is in the dawn of the 20th century, the world over, there were all of these social and economic implications of this, because suddenly all of these countries had an ability to grow enough food for their people and have surplus, which just changes a lot of socioeconomic situations.
And geopolitical situations.
Absolutely. And on the whole, like, having enough food for all the people to eat is undeniably a fantastic thing. It makes countries way more secure. You don't have as many big wars and conflicts and, hunters and uprisings and things like that, when people can just chill and there's food security. So that's a good thing. But what it did lead on to is us using nitrogen-based and ammonia fertilizers in our plants, and we haven't let go of that addiction to this day. And it's done incredibly damaging things to the soil and to the waterways that it falls into. And the other interesting side story thing I fell into while researching this was that we, it seems, have vastly underestimated the size of the problem that fertilizers are creating. Yeah. So this was from a Cornell University study that was conducted last year. They got a Google Street View car that was equipped with a high-precision methane sensor. And methane is super damaging greenhouse gas. I think it's number three in terms of how damaging they are.
I think it's 23 times worse than carbon dioxide.
There you go. The researchers discovered that the methane emissions from an ammonia fertilizer plant, so this is an industrial plant creating fertilizer, were 100 times higher than the fertilizer industry's self-reported estimate. They also were substantially higher than the EPA, that's the Environmental Protection Agency in the US, than the EPA's estimate for all industrial processes in the US. So to reframe that, from this reading that they took, just from the industry of creating fertilizer, they had underestimated it so much that the what these readings seem to suggest is that this one industry of creating fertilizer is creating more methane than they thought all of the United States was.
Oh.
Its entire economy.
Wow. What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Fertilizer production is creating more methane and putting it into the environment than they thought the whole economy was producing.
Wow, that's a whole thing we didn't even cover when in that soil episode when we covered off what the issues are with these fertilizers.
It's pretty bad.
That's massive.
I read this quote from a man called John Albertson, who's the co-author of that study that found that out, and a professor of civil and environmental engineering, I believe at Cornell, because that's where the study was from. He said, "We took one small industry that most people have never even heard of and found that its methane emissions were three times higher than the EPA assumed were emitted by all industrial production in the US. It shows us that there's a huge gap between prior estimates and real-world measurements."
Wow.
So the situation's a lot worse than we thought.
And this is beyond coffee. You've gone pretty global on that.
It's, yeah, so that's huge. All kind of food production, but that's a big part of what feeds into the environmental impact that coffee has. So let's talk about that for a moment. In terms of the greenhouse gas emissions that are produced for coffee, the first thing I wanted to have a look at was how does it stack up against other foodstuffs? So beef is number one. There's charts that you may have seen online which say for a kilogram of this food or foodstuff.
Yeah, or the calories or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. How many kgs of CO2 equivalent are released to produce that thing? So for 1 kg of beef, it's 60 kg of CO2 equivalent, of carbon dioxide equivalent.
Unbelievable.
Coffee is 17. So that makes it a
number two, or are you just picking it out?
No, sorry, I was going way down. Yep, there's a lot of stuff above it. It does make it worse than palm oil. It's worse than pig meat or poultry even. So it's got...
Okay, so it's pretty bad. What about, is cotton on there? Because that was quite bad, I remember.
I haven't written cotton down, I'm afraid, but it will be on the chart. You can definitely check that. But I was quite surprised. So what's that word that describes animals that eat grass and they get
ruminants.
Energy? Yes. So ruminant animals have a way higher profile for carbon emissions than other animals. So pigs and poultry, I didn't realize this, but because they're not ruminant, their number of CO2 equivalent is 7. 7 kg of CO2 equivalent to produce 1 kg of pig meat or chicken, poultry. But coffee, 17 kg is the number.
Okay, so why is it so high compared to, say, other grain crops or other...
Coffee?
Yeah.
Well, here's the breakdown. And I'll go from small to big, okay? So the first bit is... the smallest amount that contributes to that is the processing and transport.
Yeah.
Processing and transport. So that's about 5% of the total emissions come from that. That's really small.
And that would be pretty comparable with anything else on that list. Everything has to be transported and moved around.
I think there will be some impacts by things like weight, maybe, like the density of how much you get. So you need to put, you know, it has a different impact on shipping containers and that kind of stuff, how much you can transport it.
Sure.
The second factor, packaging, about a tenth comes of its total greenhouse gas emissions comes from packaging.
So more, this is interesting because this would be generally applicable. More impact is coming from the packaging than the transportation.
Correct. Yeah.
For what, a CO2 equivalent?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think this is just for, well, yeah, this is for greenhouse gases. Yeah. They're all lumped together, yep. I think, and then given the CO2, equivalent number. So that includes, packaging includes emissions from the production of packing materials, material transport, and end-of-life disposal.
Wow.
The next one on the list is land use, if we continue the hierarchy. So about a quarter comes from land use, and that's above ground changes in biomass from deforestation, which we know releases carbon and reduces the soil's ability to capture carbon, and below ground changes in soil carbon. So that's like retention. It stops being able to capture carbon. So then a little over half of all the greenhouse gases from coffee come from farming. And this includes emissions from fertilizers, manure, and farm machinery. So that's the big one. And it seems like fertilizer is doing a huge amount of the heavy lifting in
so
terms of the
CO2. Other words, if I'm getting this right, coffee is particularly difficult to farm because it really wants to be in the shade in this diverse environment. And so if you're comparing it to, because I'm interested in this comparison with just other crops that don't have such an impact. Like I know when we did the clothing one, we talked about cotton. One of the reasons that was so bad was because it really needed a lot of water.
Yeah.
And so maybe for coffee, it's just that it really needs a lot of fertilizer.
Yeah.
And so pesticides as well? Did you look into that?
That was mentioned a lot in the articles that I was reading. So pesticides are a huge part of this picture because, as you correctly put, like coffee plants need a really biodiverse environment for them to grow. And in the absence of that, if you're just having this monocrop, you need fertilizer to make it grow, a load of sunlight, and then you obviously need a lot of pesticides because you don't have birds. And birds are like really instrumental in pruning the insect life away from these coffee plants so that they can survive. One of the biggest losers from these monoculture, this shift to full sun cultivation of coffee has been bird life. And we know that because, like you said, the shade-grown coffee is really what we want to get back to, and some people are starting to crack onto that. As far as I could see, there is only one certification in the entire world for shade-grown coffee, and it was created by the bird department at the Smithsonian. So the Smithsonian is a collection, federal collection of museums in the United States, and they're like a scientific and sort of art curation organization that keeps all the museums and galleries going.
That's
for people.
It's a fun fact, because it's quite a bizarre group to have got. It just goes to show how linked it is.
Yeah, exactly. There was a particular guy who did some early tests by himself and kind of was scribbling stuff in a notebook and put it all together, and he was part of the Smithsonian network. So they created this this one certification that exists today for shade grown. There are a lot of brands that kind of lay claim to shade grown, and I really tried to find what Kiwi brands of coffee that are available in the supermarket we can kind of trust, but I didn't really want to wade too much into it because in the absence of a certification being there, a third party actually putting their stamp and going, we've audited this process and we know that they're not just sort of greenwashing this or saying it for marketing. There's actually something behind this. It's kind of hard to determine
so
how strong those words are.
Did you find certificate brands here?
There's no certification outside of the States whatsoever. The Smithsonian's the only certification for shade-grown coffee.
What certification did you find here?
So we do have the Rainforest Alliance seal, which is the green frog, which is sort of the closest that we can get in New Zealand.
What about organic or fair trade?
It's all in the right direction, but it does not guarantee shade-grown coffee.
If it were certified organic, that means it doesn't have the synthetic fertilizers or pesticides.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know if it completely means that it... Well, the other thing is, the great thing about the Smithsonian certification is that there are criteria for it, and I haven't written them down, but there's a few different metrics that the farmers have to reach. So there is a biodiversity metric that they have to reach.
That's cool.
So only, 50% of the trees can be part of this particular tree family. There's got to be certain heights that the trees have to reach as well. I've forgotten the word, but there's like a word for the trees that sit right at the top of the canopy that produce the huge like overarching shade. And then there's kind of middle trees, and then the coffee plants grow right in the at the foot and the root system of these other ones.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's cute, eh?
Yeah, it is. I like it. And I love that someone's sort of got a certification for it.
I know. It's so weird diversity. That it's the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
So I'll read a little quote from the American Birding Association. Because it's so funny, but they, like, the bird people seem to have the biggest, vested interest in scientific insight into this shade-grown cultivation process for coffee. And the American Birding Association said that shade coffee plantations are second only to undisturbed forests as the best habitat for birds and other fauna in Latin America. What's more is the presence of vegetation amongst coffee plants reduces the need for intense herbicide preparations. It supports at least 50% of the original forest snakes and spider fauna and protects topsoil effectively. So by getting into shade-grown coffee, it has all of these wonderful ancillary effects for the environment that you wouldn't first think of, but they're just all of the natural things that happen when you're in a complicated biodiverse environment.
Exactly. That's what I'm hearing. It's just like... you can go, oh my gosh, it's so complicated, but it's just, you're really just looking at one system versus the other. One is where you're just letting nature do all of the complicated things on your behalf and it's actually really simple. And the other is when you've taken over because you wanted to make a bit more money out of the whole thing. And when you take over and don't let nature do X, Y, Z, then it becomes very complicated.
Totally.
And suddenly you're sort of putting out these fires left, right and centre.
And we just don't know all of the processes that nature does.
No,
or even close to it.
We
so
don't.
We
yeah.
think we do, and then we start doing it and we're like, oh, this...
Yeah, whoops, so we need another chemical to do this other thing because nature's not doing it anymore.
That's exactly it. It becomes this big chemical game of whack-a-mole.
And then if we try... Sorry, I don't want to go on, but... if we try and work out these technological solutions to, oh, this problem that we've now got, that's what gets me. It's like, oh, perhaps we could just let nature do it because it was doing it so well,
yeah.
rather than trying to work out a new chemical to solve this new problem that we've created.
Yeah, that's true. I think there's probably a beautiful union of technology and traditional, practices
that we can marry together at some point.
At
all, but in terms of the framework that we're using.
Now, here's another thing. So there was a study done that found that the very trees that are good for birds may be simultaneously beneficial for farmers as well. The study highlighted the appeal of nitrogen-fixing leguminous species.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
These can absorb nitrogen in the air and transfer it down to the soil, making it more fertile. So they're doing that act of what fertilizers are doing, but in a biomechanical way, like it's a living organism.
Yeah, nitrogen fixing plants are super cool, eh? Like we've got some on the farm where it's like you can either, because you need nitrogen, right? So either you're going to be bringing it in synthetically and causing lots of havoc, or you can bring it in on your trailer full of manure or seaweed or even the coffee, actually, ironically, just like the grinds from the coffee shop.
Gotcha.
But you need good sources of nitrogen. Or the other way you can do it is just to plant a tree that fixes nitrogen. They're amazing. So simple.
I did say before that I didn't want to get too much into the New Zealand like brands and stuff because we don't have a certification here, but I do want to give a shout out to one specific company, and that is Auckland-based Incafe. Have you heard of them?
Yes.
They're New Zealand's first ever carbon zero roaster, and they seem to have most of their blends shade grown. Not all. I could find some exceptions, but it also depends on where in the world that particular blend is from, or the, or those beans are from. Makes it sometimes really complicated to get, or impossible to get shade grown. And they've got a real dedication to bird-friendly growing methods and also to completely compostable bags. And so there seems to be this real marrying of people who are very interested, or, you know, touting their interest in the bird-friendly versions. It seems like that's a good indication that they actually get the shade-grown concept, because there's this big relationship between bird life and shade-grown coffee, which is the one that we want.
And how about fair trade? Did you look into that?
Yeah, so fair trade is, I mean, fair trade's always a good thing, and you should always buy fair trade where possible. And there was a scientific study that I was reading up that said fair trade certification does naturally lead to more like ecologically sound practices overall for coffee growing specifically. So it's like always a good thing, and you should always be growing fair, you should always be buying fair trade certified coffee as well. But it doesn't guarantee specifically this one thing that, you know,
seems
to be the panacea, which is shade grown coffee. So shade grown coffee is, yeah, this, you know, globally going to be this big solution to the problem that we had with this change in methods from the 70s of sun cultivation, or sun, full sun cultivation of coffee.
And is there more of it happening?
Yeah, I assume so. It really looks like it. I've only got sort of anecdotal evidence from stuff that was popping up in front of me online, but it seems like people are paying way more attention to this than ever before. That Smithsonian certification hasn't been around that long.
Oh, okay.
So this is kind of a good new revelation that people are having about their favourite drink, which is a good thing.
Mm.
There's other environmental impacts, of course, as well for coffee. Specifically, the one that most people think of is disposable cups, and they should.
Yeah.
Because disposable cups are not great. Their paper, which is usually fine, but they're lined with plastic, which is the essential bit that makes it waterproof to keep the coffee in there, and that makes them almost impossible to recycle.
Mm. And sometimes they're PLA as well, eh?
Yes.
Which is that vegetable-based lining, which is, you can't compost that at home. It just gets all a bit complicated.
Yeah, there's definitely people who are trying to find solutions to this. And, you know, that's still better than just a purely plastic coffee cup rolling around.
What did you reckon?
Well,
in terms of what you thought a good solution might be
for disposable cups?
Well, just, you know, cups. What vessel you have your coffee in.
Rightly so. Keep cups are all good and everything. And I know I see these online wars raging about, you know, how long you've got to have a keep cup for before it actually pays for itself in terms of disposable cups. But, like, we've all got mugs, and you can use that. Like, you could have a mug in your car, and you could go into the coffee shop with the mug that you have from home, and that is all good.
It's almost like a socially acceptable thing.
Just do it.
It's like we've paved the way now with the keep cups. And now people are, I think actually, because people are saying this, I'm hearing this all the time now, people are saying, just take a mug.
I know. And like, I know.
Why do you have to have a special thing?
I know people are different and stuff, but like, I wouldn't have any issue just take a mug from home.
Okay.
It's fine.
Let's talk this
You
through.
Don't have to buy a solution to
if
this
you
problem.
Are
You've got one.
Sitting down.
Yeah.
You would have their cup anyway. You wouldn't have to take one from home.
Absolutely.
So if you're on the go.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in your car or something, or you can just keep a gosh darn coffee cup in there.
Well, you can't get the mug in because of the handle sticking out. You can't get it down that hole.
Yeah, you can. Well, it's not going to be full of coffee when it's in there. You can find a little spot to put it in there.
Yeah.
This is not a hard thing that people have to do to get rid of a big problem of disposable cups, which is a huge problem. We throw away millions of them every year.
But actually, just on that though, you can get ceramic keep cups.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. Yes, that's true. And ceramic are good. I really like the collapsible ones too, even though they're made out of silicone. Ooh, but they're like, because then they fit anywhere. They're pretty cool. So get a mug is what I would say from home. But also keep cups are all good. Disposable cups are bad. It's nice that people are finding solutions for them. Eco-wear and innocent packaging are trying to improve things. They use the plant-based bioplastics for the coating and the lids instead, and which means the whole cup's compostable.
If you did have a compostable cup, what would you do with it?
Well, you've got to check that if it's home compostable or industrial compostable.
But and then you've got to compost it.
Yeah.
You can't just chuck it in the rubbish.
Yeah. Exactly.
Putting that out there.
Zed Energy switched on to, they sell 4.5 million takeaway coffees every year, and they swapped over to compostable cups. So like
this here in NZ,
things are happening. Huh, yeah.
Wow.
So there's also the human factor. Coffee growers are generally poor and in developing countries or countries that have quite vulnerable economies. And as a commodity, coffee's incredibly volatile. This is a little bit of a side story thing, but from 1962 to 88, the UN had the International Coffee Organization, which set prices to avoid a mismatch between supply and demand. It's kind of the same thing you get with, what is it called, OPEC, with the oil. You want to control how much is going out. They took their hands off the wheel and really screwed up in 1988, and it plunged the coffee industry into a massive crisis where the market got flooded with too many beans, and so the prices crashed and it wiped out all of these farmers. And when that happens in such a highly traded commodity, the farmers can lose everything because they can't sell the beans for the cost it made to produce them. So when that happened in 1988, that's when Fair Trade was born. So the precursor to Fair Trade was an organization that had a Dutch name, which I won't pronounce, from the Netherlands. And it was born out of that, and it set an artificial price floor so that coffee farmers could survive.
That's interesting.
That's what it came out of. So another reason why you should support Fair Trade.
Coffee is such a significant commodity, isn't it? It's even birthed the Fair Trade movement.
Absolutely, yeah. So those are all my bits of paper that I'm furious I've been shuffling around. But coffee... incredible thing.
Cool history.
I love it to bits. Yeah. Really fascinating history. It's got such an important part of our like global culture and most of our lives when you really think about it. And it's a good thing. I don't want this podcast to be a thing where we just wave our finger at you, you know, constantly about the things you need to do. But there are ways to improve your coffee drinking for the good of the planet. And they are... let's see if we can support any companies that really get into shade-grown coffee. Always buy fair trade and certified organic, please. And let's get rid of the use of disposable cups, whether that be for you buying a keep cup if you don't have one already, or ideally just bringing a coffee cup or a mug from home into the cafe, keeping that in the car. Or, you know, beyond that, maybe eventually us lobbying the government to make some legal changes around disposable coffee cups like we did with single-use plastic bags.
Yeah, I like it. It's, in terms of this episode and this focus, it's because it's a nice, simple one. We're looking at one commodity and it's so easy to do the right thing because it never sits well, even when the word's coming out of your own mouth, I don't think, if you say, oh, I can't afford to buy organic coffee, because it's like, it's coffee. You know,
it's a non-essential item. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's like if you, I know some people wouldn't agree with that, but it's we have to be able to make good choices around these things where we can. It's like chocolate too. It's a nice, easy thing to do the right thing with.
Buying certified organic coffee is not that much more expensive at all. The non-certified coffee in most cases, unless you're getting like instant coffee and then that's a whole other different thing. But if you're buying coffee for your house or coffee at a cafe, like, guys, it kind of should be fair trade and organic at this point.
Yeah. And to be fair, we're getting there, aren't we?
We are.
Like it's not sort of some weird hard thing anymore.
Not anymore. No. Which is good.
Yeah.
So that is How to Save the World's episode on coffee. It's been a pleasure bringing it to you.
Thanks, Tim. I love how you did this one because you're the coffee drinker. If we ever do a tea episode, I'll do the tea.
Awesome. Maybe we'll get Di back in for that one
Yeah, he needs to do the tea.
Di Hemwood loves it. We will catch you in the next episode of How to Save the World. But until then, share this episode around with any coffee drinkers in your life. And you can rate us and review us on iTunes, which helps other people find the show as well. Until the next episode... stay sustainable. Did you like that?
Yeah.